listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot's beautiful book, Exit, The Endings That Set Us Free, of course, makes me think of exits in the life of my family, as I'm sure they will for you too. For me, it's emigration from Eastern Europe for my grandparents, my father departing for combat in the Pacific, my mother's last days before succumbing to cancer. And I thought of my own so far, leaving for college, ending one marriage, losing a job, beginning another, ending a stale friendship along the way. Professor Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot is indeed a wise guide and a superb storyteller, turning our attention to the grace and the courage of exits at every stage of the life cycle. I'm interested in every book that Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot writes because I know I will refer to it for years to come. She is a MacArthur Prize-winning sociologist and currently the Emily Hargroves Fisher Professor of Education at Harvard University. Professor Lawrence Lightfoot has studied the culture of families, of communities, and of schools. She's the author of 10 books, including The Third Chapter, Respect, The Essential Conversation, and Baum and Gilead, which won the 1988 Christopher Award for Literary Merit and Humanitarian Achievement. And in conversation with Professor Lawrence Lightfoot tonight, we have Robin Kramer. And having citizens like Robin Kramer in our city is partly what makes Los Angeles a great city. She's been an active leader in Los Angeles civic affairs for over three decades. She was the first woman to hold the position of chief of staff to both Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa and Richard Reardon, and was a senior executive at the California Community Foundation, the Broad Foundation, and Coro Southern California. She's currently working as senior advisor to the Annenberg Retreat at Sunnylands, and she also serves as one of five commissioners of the Port of Los Angeles and recently made a fact-finding trip to Panama. She's also a delight to work with in every way. Please welcome our two distinguished guests to the stage of the Los Angeles Public Library. Please welcome Professor Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot and Robin Kramer. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to what I'm sure is going to be a fun and interesting evening. I just wanted to say that I received this book to read while I was listening to the music of Turn, 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 To Everything There's a Season, and while I was packing to go to my goddaughter's college graduation. So I was thinking, coincidence? I don't think so. And so if we could enter the book with a bit from it, maybe you would read a section from the first chapter, Home.
These familiar rhythms and resonances from home stretch across the globe, from Washington, D.C. to Tehran, and across the years as Bijan pleads with his father over the phone, begging to come back to Iran. He is desperate and miserable, sick, hungry, and lonely. Over and over, father and son cut a deal that they both know will never see the light of day. Over and over, they play the brain game, knowing the dueling exchanges by heart, shielding each other from the truth. As they rehearse the familiar script, Bijan listens for what Paulie Marshall calls the language and poetry of home. The deals and exits last for years and years until Bijan, flush with a new resolve and the surprise bounty from his tax returns, decides to stage his own homecoming. His parents, sister and brothers, their spouses and children, 11 of them in all, crowd into a tiny studio apartment in Turkey, a place that none of them call home. For seven delicious days, they experience the thrill and familiarity of one another's company, an orgy of eating, drinking, and most of all, talking and telling stories. As Bijan says his farewells and his precious family returns to the country where he was born and raised, the place to which he has been dying to return, the idea of home and belonging are transfigured. He has an epiphany. Home is where the love is, a place that is impossible to leave. In many ways, Bijan's exit from the parental home seems archetypal. It reminds us of the stories played out in fairy tales, myths, legends, and memoirs. The son leaves in due course to start his own family, or he runs away, or he is cast out. All three leave-takings are emotionally searing. All three have their share of turmoil. Even if the exit in the first scenario is anticipated and planned, even if it fits with what is deemed developmentally and culturally appropriate, it may still be a departure filled with ambivalence, conflict, relief, and liberation. But the drama seems heightened in the exits that deviate from the conventional mold. Those who run away from the parental home and those who are kicked out are exiting an untenable situation. Running away may be a desperate act, but it is an act of will. It is an exit of one's own choosing. Being kicked out is a forced exit, a circumstance that wasn't chosen, but one that must be endured and survived, where the connections to home are harder to repair or brutally severed forever. Bijan's departure weaves together all three archetypal narratives. He chooses to leave. He surprises himself by saying, "I'll go." But the choice comes on the heels of his older brother's staunch refusal and his younger brother's tragic death. As soon as the words escape his mouth, it does not feel like free choice. It is a choice made out of loyalty, the son protecting his parents from additional unbearable grief. As soon as he arrives in New York, he wants to run back to his mother's waiting arms and feel the softness and warmth of her bosom. But his leave-taking is also a story of running away from the seductions of radical politics, from the war, the violence, the bloodshed, and a story of being cast out by a father who does it out of love, not punishment or anger. The father's insistence that he go and stay away are indicative of the tremendous protection and life-giving care he feels for Bijan. Exiting home is a family love story.
Beautiful. Thank you very, very much. So home seems like a great place to start a conversation here, not only here in this beautiful space, but also in Los Angeles, which is a home where people have come from. And of course, not all exits are love stories or about family. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us more about the exits that you discovered? And first off, why you even came to write this book?
Well, it's hard to know where to begin. One of the thoughts I had today was that my mother used to say to us, there are three of us children, that her favorite view of us was of our backs. She loved to watch us walk away deeper and deeper into the world. She loved the thought that her children were growing more and more autonomous and independent. And then several decades later, when I had young children and they would leave for school, every morning, I would run to the window to watch their backs, to see whether they were standing tall, to see whether their spines were strong, to see whether they had what it took, what would take to sort of endure what was likely to be for every kid an imperfect day. And so I have always been interested in people's leaving and departures, and I've always been struck by how little attention is paid to even the most ordinary and the most extraordinary exits. And sort of the conceit of this book is that we live in a culture that is so preoccupied with beginnings, with launches, with embarkings. You know, we are a society where people are always tilting forward, seizing the next opportunity, you know, waiting for the moment, poised for mobility. And in the process, we neglect or pay very little attention to our exits, I think. And we even often think of them as retreats or the negative spaces in our life journeys. And so this book is really about paying a lot of attention to exits. It's about exploring a large variety of exits. It's about saying that if we look through the prism of exit, we will see a whole bunch of human experiences quite differently, including our experience of home, our experience of voice, our experience of freedom, our experience of wounds. These are the chapter titles. I spent a lot of time, right, talking to dozens of people about their experiences of exit, their exit narratives.
And of all of these genres of leave-taking that you discovered or uncovered, which one has most surprised you? You're meant to illuminate here. So what did you find?
Well, I found surprises sort of in all of them. Mm. First of all, I found it surprising how hard it is to begin a story at the end. You know, in other words, we are taught that there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to the story. So really, when you want people, just methodologically, as a social scientist, to start at the end, it's hard to know where to begin, right? and this was a huge challenge for people. I also think that it was revelatory immediately for people that once you sort of said, I really want to explore these exits, how easy it was for them to then attend to it. And how the exits there were two kinds of exits, I found, across all of these. And this was a surprise. What the notion of exit signs bold and blurred, right? So everyone I talked to could picture the moment when they finally said, I'm out of here, right? When all of the forces and sensations came together in a perfect storm and you realized, no more, I'm out of here. And at that moment, they could tell me what they were wearing, who they were with, how their heart started pounding, you know, bodily kind of experiences in that moment, vivid, electric, like technicolor, right? On the one hand, exit signs bold. But the blurred part is if they looked retrospectively across time, they realized that the exits were really iterative. You know, they took a long time to get to that moment of climax, to get to that moment of announcement. And they were pretty messy. There was nothing kind of linear or rational about this. There was a lot of circling around, a lot of ambivalence, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of fear, a lot of sort of circling back. That was one of the surprises, these sort of two kinds of exits that everyone doing these very different kinds of exits talked about.
Tell us a little more about those different kinds of exits to give folks a flavor of these beautiful stories.
Yeah. Well, Bijan is the person you heard of who was leaving Iran during the war and who was leaving at age 16. And he had been very, very active in the resistance movement with his brother, very dangerous. And his younger brother had been electrocuted when electricity came to town, right? And it was poorly wired. And his brother stepped out of a wading pool in the backyard and touched a pole and was fried. I was just fried, 13 years old. And the father was just desperate that all of his sons, the two oldest, might be killed in this movement, this radical political movement, and the younger one had already been killed. So he begged his sons to leave. And Bijan said, I'll go, because his older brother refused to, and he wanted to save his parents from grief. That's one story. The next story is about a gay activist man exiting from the closet and finding home and wholeness exiting from the closet. It's a very courageous, exuberant story in which he really does talk about this moment of understanding that he had to come out, but then says coming out is not binary. It is iterative, right? It is like peeling an onion, removing all the layers of mask and persona and finding, my goodness, myself, my authentic self, finding home and wholeness, ultimately. There's a story of an anthropologist who spends 4 years in the field, working with Mexican-American mothers in Denver who are learning to be cute community organizers. And it is a story of how she recognizes that she must be very purposeful, respectful, careful, and deliberate about her exit from the field. Those of us who do this kind of work as social scientists and anthropologists and sociologists, we read these methodology texts which talk about gaining access to the field, right? Entering the field. And they talk a lot about what it means to be a participant observer and how to be both intimate and detached. They talk about mapping the field. They talk about gaining the trust of the respondents, etc. But at the end of this methodology text, they never talk about the exit. Mm. They never talk about the responsibilities, the moral and ethical responsibilities. They never really talk about the empirical implications of the exit, right? And so this is a book where we really talk about, with this anthropologist, about her deliberate exit. There's a story about a woman who has started a nonprofit for young people, adolescents, in rural Wisconsin. Most of these kids have been pushed out of school. They've been terrible failures in school, and she sets up a kind of an educational ecology, an environmental program for them. And she spawns this wonderful nonprofit, and she gives her whole life to it for 25 years. And after 25 years, she realizes the organization needs new leadership in order to continue to grow, and she, at 55, needs to leave if she's going to have another life. And so she stages and chooses her exit, and it's purposeful, and it's clear, and it's public, and there's a lot of performance and ceremony about it, and as soon as it happens, she's despairing. And she feels marginalized, and she feels empty. There's a story of a psychotherapist and how she works with her patients to help them exit from their old wounds, from their abusive past, from their neuroses, from their alcoholism, at the same time as she's preparing them to exit from, this is what psychotherapists call termination from therapy. There's a story of a attending physician in an intensive care unit who is teaching his residents, guiding his residents in helping them recognize how to prepare their patients for one of two exits. The exit back to the floor of the hospital and hopefully full recovery, and the exit to death. Mm-hmm. And there are other exits, but that gives you a sense of the range.
So the book itself uses these stories. You use these stories, not exploit these stories. You use these stories to make a point and to create these genres and typologies, and you weave scholarly and academic research in your own views. Curious to know, what is it about storytelling that is so important for thinking about leave-taking?
Well, you know, in all of my work, I have been interested in developing a methodology. I have developed a methodology called portraiture, which is intentional in seeking to blend art and science, literary narrative with empirical description. And my decision to try to do this kind of work really grew out of feeling that, lots of feeling, but that the typical social science lenses and methodologies don't have a way, for the most part, of capturing the sort of context, the phenomenological experience and meaning-making of individuals in a way that really tells a story, right? It tends to be using sort of relatively static categories that express the either-or of human experience. And my experience of human beings is it's rarely that way. Most of our experience is both and about everything. So exits are about typically loss and liberation, for example. Mm-hmm. How do you bring those together? And I think you can bring those together by creating narrative, by creating stories. I also think that there's a way of blending both my voice as interpreter and narrator and the voices of these protagonists in a way that you get this kind of lovely, I hope, duet and of experiences and meaning-making throughout this piece as well.
So you said today, and you, in your book you wrote, that the agony of exit seems to be the dominant narrative in our culture and a very huge focus on beginnings. So what can we learn from these stories and from other cultures or religion that might give us a hint, a clue, not a how-to, about some of the rituals or possibilities to make exits meaningful, purposeful, better?
Yes. Well, I think, you know, if we compare ourselves to almost any other, particularly non-Western culture, we recognize that we really don't have the rites and rituals and ceremonies to accompany our leave takings, for the most part. I mean, that most other people have a grand way, a colorful way, a dramatic way, a tearful way of saying goodbye, right? You watch Russians, right, at train stations, and you think, oh my goodness, what's happening? There's something big happening here. And you know that someone has left, right? And the leaving person feels as if there's been a community there saying goodbye, you know, and it's very wonderful. It's all movie-like, right? And I think that in all of these goodbyes, we recognize there's a need for marking the occasion somehow in a communal, collective way, naming it, noticing it, attending to it. And I think it's even better if you bring some kind of art into it, because of course that's a much more expressive form. It's music, dance, theater, role play, ways of moving it beyond the rational, the expedient, to something that is expressive and heartfelt and soulful. I feel my goodbyes really in my gut. It's in my body. And a lot of these people talking about goodbyes that are incomplete, goodbyes not done well, talk about how it hits their bodies, it makes them sick. Two of the women in this story, it's a mother of a child who's been bullied since he was a kindergartner to the time he was in fifth grade, just enduring the terrible, terrible bullying of Richie and his gangs, these same kids who made him be a soldier. This is when he came as a kindergartner, right? And they keep beating him up. And his mother tries to protect him over and over, tries to get the teachers to be vigilant in protecting him, the principals to be, approaches the parents of the bulliers, who then tell her that she should mind her own business and their kids are not involved in this and so forth. It's... You know, they keep at it, trying to make it right. And finally, by fifth grade, it's done. And the mother says, finally, when she convinces her boy, and she has convinced herself, she says, we are not quitting. We are done. Mm. Right? We are done. And very soon after, she realizes that she gets a call from a doctor, an oncologist. She's gotten breast cancer. And she says that she doesn't even need the call. She just knew it was lodged in her body. And there are other examples of this. I don't mean to be melodramatic about it, but I do think that the rituals and rites need to be soulful, expressive, embodied, collective, communal occasions. And I argue in this book that this needs to be a cultural agenda. Somehow we've got to find a way, as well as an individual and an institutional agenda.
It reminds me, there was a play here at the Mark Taper Forum, I believe it was called The Nine Armenians. And it was a play about an extended family of Armenians leaving a party. And the whole play is in the front yard, because yes, their leave-taking is very sweet and very long.
Very, yeah, that's right.
Very long and very beautiful.
That's right. Is
there anything, because you said this is an iterative process and a journey, is there anything we could learn about these individuals whom you interviewed or our culture's fascination with beginning that might apply to making ending well? Is there anything we could learn from how we begin, whether it's ritual, approach, enthusiasm? Is there anything at all? Are they such two separate creatures?
No, I don't know that they're two separate creatures. I think that all I can think of is that we can figure out a discipline of recognizing how we so embrace beginnings and try to embrace endings with the same kind of attitude, the same kind of stance, mm-hmm. with the same kind of vision. I really do think that if we miss attending to exits, we miss half the story of our life narrative, right? We miss half of the story. And I think we miss the opportunity to be reflective, to think of exits as generative, to think of exits as moments of propulsion rather than retreat. One of the people who I refer to, I always seem to refer to him at least once every book, is Erik Erikson, the developmental psychologist, who talks about, you know, eight life stages across the life cycle. And each one of these stages is focused on a tension or a conflict between moving forward and moving back or staying still, between progression and regression. And and the penultimate stage of we third chapter folks is either generativity or stasis, right? Mm-hmm. I recognize in talking to these folks who are exiting that either consciously or unconsciously, in choosing progression, we are also choosing exit, right? Mm-hmm. And so that exits are absolutely critical for our human development, for evolving as human beings and developing as human beings. It's part of the sort of, it's part of our life story.
One of the fascinating things I think you described through this process is something you called yearning. I think you wrote that it took a little while for you to figure out exactly what the word was or what the sentiment was. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about yearning in this exiting move.
Well, it's interesting because very little has been written about exits. And there's one book that's written by Hirschman, and it was published, a little teeny thin book by Harvard University Press, had a huge impact. It was called Exit, Voice, and Loyalty. He's an economist talking about exits from organizations. Then there was one more recently, but still I think in the late 80s, that was sort of stage theories of exit, you know. Mm. And in both of those cases, I couldn't pick up what I was hearing from all 45 people who I interviewed, which was this sense of longing, yearning for something more meaningful, something more satisfying, something more generative in their lives. Some people could identify it, someplace they wanted to go, but some people, it was really ephemeral. It was unclear, but it was in them. And so in the voices was this, what I began to call yearning. In the chapter on yearning is a story of a Catholic priest who loves being a priest. Loves all about that vocation, the service of it, the working with parishioners, the liturgy. He even loves secretly the ways in which the people he works with, his parishioners, put him up on a pedestal, right? But even before he committed to being a priest, he's from a very Catholic, Italian, working class family. Both of his parents had more than 12 siblings, and his father was, I think, finished the eighth grade. His mother was one of those rare working-class Italian mothers who went to college at least for 2 years until she got married to his father. So this very working class Italian parochial school experience that he had. But he chose to be a priest, but even in choosing, he knew that there would be a problem with celibacy. He just knew it going into it. But he pushed forward. When he went to Villanova University and fell in love with a young woman, and they had a relationship for most of the 4 years, he even knew then that this was going to end. And finally, by senior year, he had decided to become a priest. But all through his priesthood, he was haunted by this yearning for a woman. Not just the sex, but the whole experience of intimacy and the whole experience of companionship, even playfulness and flirtation. He missed all of that. He wanted that. So he had these two lives, this priest who was absolutely satisfied and pleased with his life and his vocation and his meaning, the meaning he had in people's lives, but also this yearning and this grief and this sadness. And ultimately, he left the priesthood. But I think a lot of the exits here are defined a lot by this sort of inchoate, ephemeral, but very, very deeply felt yearning to move on.
And in that regard, the subtitle here is called The Endings That Set Us Free. So it sounds like this individual, he was set free in many ways.
He was, but one of the real kickers in this story that I found really interesting and that he found interesting when he talked to me, because people have epiphanies, right, when they tell these stories they never realized before, was that there was a kind of, that celibacy offered him a kind of closeness to his parishioners, a kind of intimacy, that of trust and rapport. He was the good kind of priest, right? Where it was the good, caring, compassionate, trustworthy kind of priest. And that when he left, even with the, and he found a woman and they got married, and there was that kind of intimacy, but he says, when he talks to me, he said, you know, that's interesting. I've never, ever experienced again the kind of intimacy and closeness that I had with my parishioners.
How do you get these folks to open up in this incredible way? How does that happen?
I listen. The older I get, the better I listen. And it's interesting how few questions you need to ask in order to get people to tell their stories. I think they feel my identification, and there's nothing fake or phony about that. People start telling their stories, and I'm right there, and I really feel many of these things myself. I also, if they ask for my story back, I willingly give it. They know that I will, and so they rarely ask. Right? It is their opportunity to be listened to. You know how very few opportunities we have as human beings to have someone just sit and listen to us uninterrupted, unjudged, not talking over us or waiting to pounce or thinking that they know the answer better than we do. I mean, we talk to friends and we talk to our partners and loved ones, and we talk to our kids. And I know that my kids were always saying that I would ask them a question and they would begin to answer, and I would, you know, they could see me, you know, ready to pounce, right? Ready with a better answer than they gave, you know? I mean, and I, but as a researcher, I'm not like I am as a mother. And I'm just ready to just listen as long as it takes. And it doesn't even require restraint on my part anymore. And the other thing is that I'm just deeply curious. And I do tell my graduate students who I'm teaching research methodology courses to, I say the essential quality of a researcher is curiosity. You have to be deeply, endlessly curious about the human condition, and I just am.
Do people in your research and your listening, do they learn how to exit from their families, from their family experience? Yes, no, indifferent, all over the map.
I think most people do learn or don't learn how to exit. I mean, one of the people who I talk to in this book, who's a very successful kind of philanthropist, she started off by being a lawyer. She then went into philanthropy, has done a number of things, both on the global and national level. And she talked about the fact that she grew up in a family that just never, ever recognized endings or leave takings or exits or things coming to completion, right? Mm. And she had a father who was very successful scientist and entrepreneur, and he used to always say, "What's next for you, Carla? You know, what's up? What's next?" There was always "what's next." And one of the things that she said was that she recognized when she became a mom and was raising children that she very much wanted to imprint into her family these rituals that recognized endings. Mm-hmm. And she recognized that this was not only not like the family that she had grown up in, but this was sort of countercultural, mm-hmm. that in general, our culture didn't do this. And she recognized in putting these rituals in place within her family, this was not only not like she had been socialized, but also not what our mm-hmm. culture generally does.
And so if you were the culture czarina and could imagine a way for the collective to learn more about exit taking, what advice or what scepter would you send forth? Because these are individual stories drawn from mm-hmm. the experience of individuals. So mm-hmm. what could the collective, what could our community learn about how to exit one phase and move to another?
Well, I do think it begins at the individual level, and it begins in families, right? So I think there are lots of ways in which we can, as parents, begin to sort of develop moments, rituals, rites, ceremonies in our own families that that allow us to exit in a way that's attentive and purposeful and reflective. I do. I also think I have seen it in schools, in classrooms, where teachers set up a set of rituals, even ways of ending the day, you know. And sometimes these are sort of artistic moments. You know, Jeffrey, it's your turn to read the goodbye poem. What have you chosen for us today, right? Or singing, a way of saying goodbye. I remember with my children, I always sang them to sleep. And this was always, according to my kids, a goodbye until the morning. That even in those little moments, we recognize goodbye. And I think that schools, you know, they usually save it for graduation, and then they call it commencement rather than graduation, right? So they even miss that opportunity,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And so, but schools, you can imagine trying to figure out moments as well. These have to be, though, moments that are substantive, that have real meaning for people, right? That aren't like giving a gold watch or a rocking chair after 25 years of service. You know, that really, where there's something about this that really recognizes the contribution, the imprint, the meaning that this person has had within this organization, within this school, within this family, within this community. And, you know, everywhere I've gone, as I've been talking about this book in the last couple of weeks, people come up with stories of incomplete and unsatisfying and sad and fractured and frustrating exits. in organizations that they've had, or in saying goodbye to a dying parent, you know. And there are ways of, I don't want to say fixing it because that sounds too mechanical, but there are ways of reframing it so that these don't have to be unsatisfying, painful, difficult moments that you look back on retrospectively and said, damn, I missed that opportunity.
So if, though this is not a how-to book, not one bit.
Not one bit.
If we could think about ways to end well, mm-hmm. what would be some of the most critical elements to end well?
Well, I think to end well, we have to, I keep using these words, but mark it, name it, attend to it. Not brush by it, not move past it, and not ignore it, right? Mm. I think we end best by letting other people know we're ending, right? So that there is, we leave, I say this in the book, in the reluctant arms of the community, right? So there is a community around us, something collective about this experience. I also think that if we give it ritual, if we invent or innovate ritual, or if we take old rituals and give them new meaning, then I think rituals allow us to experience that often paradoxical blend of emotions that always accompany leave-taking. You know, that there is some joy, there's always some pain.
Yeah.
Right? That there is always some gain and there's always some loss. Right? And that somehow, if we attend to these only as sort of rational statements, then we only recognize the gain, right? Moving forward, you know, the purposefulness. And we don't have a way of embracing the mix of emotions that's very much there.
So something about, it's very fitting that we talk about being allowed in this series,
allowed.
The Allowed series.
And I think the other thing that good endings allow us to do is to tell the story. It's storytelling time, right? And tell us the story about, you know, let's review some of that, you know, and I think stories are the best way to do it. And I think there is also the opportunity, and we see this when we see people who are dying well,
yes.
right? We see that this is a moment for reconciliation, for having the conversations that we didn't dare to have before, for telling the truth if we dare to, right? Mm-hmm. We're crossing the bridge to the other person. Mm-hmm. And I think that although we see that often in dying well, I think that's true of other endings as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I mentioned to you earlier, the Allowed series goers are lovers of books
yes.
and believers in authors. And have an and have a deep curiosity about how an author who is writing about exits would end her book. And so I thought about this a lot, and I'm curious if I could convince you to read the last little bit here to give everyone a glimpse of the end.
Hard to do. Figure out an end to the book about endings. Exits hold that power, that inevitability. If we begin our journey toward home, our quest for freedom, our yearning for a meaningful life, if we choose to lift up our voices in celebration and protest, if we survive the exit wounds and walk forward with grace, we will move inexorably to the exit. In seeing our lives through the lens of the exit, we transfigure the journey. We feel the electric charge of anticipation. We learn to celebrate completion, and we witness the triumph of beauty that is the end. Whether it is a refreshing dip in the water, the sweet taste of ice cream, or the radiance and resolution of the final chord in Bach's B minor Mass.
Brava.
Thank you.
experience will show this is not an unopinionated crowd. And so we'll close this chapter, and the questions on the floor are yours. Coming your way.
What pieces of literature would you recommend to accompany your book?
There is a chapter here on freedom, and it begins with Jean-Paul Sartre's No Exit. I think that's pretty wonderful and hard and harsh. I mention in one of the passages I read a book by Pauli Marshall, Brown Girl, Brown Stones, in which Pauli Marshall is a wonderful, wonderful writer who writes about the Bayesian community in Brooklyn and their sort of sense of home, and accompanies very much the piece on Bijan. Joan Didion writes a wonderful essay on home in her book Slouching Towards Bethlehem. Isn't that the book of essays? So scattered through, I mean, I'm much less a social scientist in this book. That is, many of the references here that I take off from are to literature and poetry. There's a wonderful piece by W.E.B. Du Bois on beauty and death, in which he talks about beauty as demanding an end and ugliness as being inevitable. I mean, it just goes on and on and on, without an end. But beauty requires completion. It is not only that beauty is in ending, but how we end that is beautiful. And that's a wonderful piece as well that I would recommend to you.
Other questions?
Thank you again, sitting next to a woman leaving a company this week that she's founded. So perfect timing. But you referenced interviewing a physician in the intensive care unit and dealing with patients. Curious, however, if you spoke or interviewed to someone on the verge of dying, and in terms of exits, it's kind of the ultimate exit, and were there any unique and or, I guess, similar observations about the themes that you've been talking about in the ultimate exit of death, and did you explicitly interview people in that regard and have any comparisons to other exits?
I did not interview someone who was dying. I did interview the wife of a man, Gwen, the wife of a man named Tom Taylor, who had died about a month before I interviewed her. And she had he had asked to die at home. He was dying of incurable cancer. Both of his parents had died at home, and he wanted to be surrounded by family and friends. And she staged a monumental exit in the intimacy of their home, moved his bed out into the middle of the living room, and his five children, middle-aged children, came from all over the world where they were working and were there and present, having these difficult, complicated conversations with him that they hadn't been able to have before. His daughters were, he was sort of trading places with his children, that his daughters were making beautiful garments to put on his withering body. His sons were feeding him breakfast and reading him the newspaper like he used to read them bedtime stories. Friends were coming from far and near with fruit and vegetables from their gardens, and with music and with poetry and with memories and musings, with political duels with old friends about what was happening in the world. It was the fabulous conversations, the sense of the bonding of community and friendship and that really sustained him until the end. And Gwen, this wife, orchestrated all of that until finally he died, and she participated
in oiling his body after he died. It was an extraordinary story of ending well, of completing a life. It wasn't, I mean, she talked about oiling his body, and she said, you know, when she turned him over, she and his sons turned him over, you know, all this stuff came out of his mouth, right? All this yucky, gucky, brown stuff came out. And what she was saying was, it wasn't pretty, but it was absolutely beautiful, the entire experience. What was it about that experience that was that we could learn about other endings? I mean, I think partly it was this sort of sense of bonding with community. It was the opportunity at that moment to have these conversations, that with his children, that no one had been able to have before, where there had been silences and fear and opaqueness. Finally, there was clarity and trust and difficult conversations. I think there was something about the generational shift that happened, passing it along, yeah. You know, which I think is something that other exits can learn about. So there was lots there, I think. The storytelling, the imagining, as well as the fact that it wasn't so much that Tom Taylor was in control, but he had a lot of agency. He was very much a part of creating, imagining, envisioning, insisting upon this final ritual.
You mentioned our obsession with beginnings, and I wondered if you, with your stories and your interviews, had any clue as to why that is. And then secondly, did you run across any cultures or individuals where exits were obsessed upon and beginnings were forgotten?
No to that second question, but I didn't. All of these interviews were here in the United States, across this country. So my impressions of other places come from doing a lot of international travel, but not doing real research or any kind of systematic interviewing of people. I think we are a culture that, in general, moves very fast. Speed, we care a lot about speed. We care a lot about the sort of hierarchical ladders. I always see us in a sort of a pyramidal shape, moving on to the next, higher and higher, rather than another cultural shape you can think about, which is sort of circular, right, where beginnings and endings sort of merge one into the other. And so I think we are a very sort of impatient, aggressive, hierarchical, pyramidal, what more can I say, society. Pointed, right? And that's how we respond almost viscerally, right? And this is the way I study schools and education. This is the way we do it in schools, right? And I think there's something that's asking here for more time and more deliberation and more restraint. I think, in the noticing of exits as well.
I was wondering, how did you select the people whom you talked to, whom you interviewed, and got their stories? This is my first question, and my second question is whether you planned your own exit.
Have I planned my own exit? Yes. From where, life? I'm trying to be as alive as I can here, aloud. Loud and alive. Let's try to remember the first question. Oh. The first question, you know, in a very meticulously scientific way, I did what social scientists call a snowball sample. And that is this, that you sort of send out a message to your friends and acquaintances and anyone who cares
I'm writing, I'm really trying to study exits. Do you know anyone who's done an interesting exit recently, right? Or who is anticipating one, or has done one in the very far past? And someone will say, I suggest so-and-so, and you go and talk to so-and-so. In fact, it's a very interesting story. And when you're done, you say, by the way, do you know anyone who's done something interesting? So it grew like that. And in fact, I interviewed about 45 or 46 people. I decided to focus on the 12 people who are sort of portrayed in this book because I really wanted to get the fullness of the story, a portrait that was sort of deep and complex. I felt that was a much better way of examining exits than to look across thematically all 45 people. And so I chose people who where there was a great variety and diversity of ways of dealing with exit and of the exits. I knew, for example, that I wanted to end the book with the ultimate exit of death. And the last chapter is called Grace, and the last part of the chapter is called Amazing Grace. I knew, just because this has been a big preoccupation of mine, that I wanted to interview an anthropologist, because I think we have been terribly wrong in the ways we've exited communities that have given us the most precious thing that they have, which is their life stories and their experiences and their voices, and we walk like we're stealing stuff. And so I really wanted to talk to someone who is paying attention to that. So there were categories of people. I knew I wanted to interview a priest or someone in the ministry. But I, other than that, I really, I had no great plan. I haven't yet planned my exit. I do know that I want Bach's B minor Mass going. If it's a cast of thousands in the Requiem of my life. But I must say that, as with all of my work, this required deep personal exploration. I have just celebrated my 40th year at Harvard. It's about time. And though I started at 11, it still is about time. And so this really forced a kind of self interrogation and thoughtfulness about that, and a sensitivity to the ways in which I want to exit that place, feeling good, feeling strong, feeling powerful, head held high, rather than just sort of slinking off in the night. And I don't know when that's going to be, but it's soon.
Please.
Hi. Anecdotally, it seems to me that our culture is also one obsessed with novelty. And so there tends, and again, I work with young people, so maybe my viewpoint is a little skewed. It seems that people don't stick with anything for very long, whether it's a job or their marriages or whatever it may be, living in a house or an apartment for very long. So I'm wondering if in your research you found that the quality of people's leave-taking had any correspondence to how long they stuck with something. Because I think especially of the woman who founded the nonprofit, 25 years. Obviously, someone's death, many years invested in their life. Part of my concern is that young people aren't staying with something long enough to leave it well. Does that make any sense? And
yeah.
Your reflections on that?
It's a great question. I don't know that I have an answer to it. I think in all the cases here are people who stuck with stuff long enough to have a reasonable exit, where exit was something that had to have meaning and purposefulness, and maybe that's a skewed sample for sure, because I like your observation about novelty, and I like your observation about you need to stick with something long enough for exit to have any real meaning. So I actually hadn't thought of that before, but definitely the people who even of the 45 people, none of those had a sort of a superficial acquaintance with whatever it was they were leaving, but felt deeply invested in it, and it was hard to do.
Yeah. The half hour here has given me the nod. We have two more questions. Please.
Yes.
First, as a storyteller, I love your emphasis on story.
Thank you.
You go, girl.
Yes.
And you said something, I just want to be sure I have it right. You said it's not either or, it's not just either or, but, and I don't know.
I think I said probably both and.
Okay, I did have it right.
That, in other words, that this the typical way in which we build categories as social scientists is to sort of put things in boxes that it's either that or that, right? It's high or low, it's black or white, it's good or bad. These are often arranged hierarchically as well, right? And my experience now in sort of getting people to tell their stories and trying to understand the meaning is that for most of human experience, this isn't how we live. We live with both. And we, in fact, part of what's interesting in life is embracing these contradictions. And one of the things I think about maturity is recognizing as we get older how much we can embrace in terms of these what are typically thought of as classifications or polarities, but they're just always meshing and merging and bridging, right? And there's all this way in which it comes together in with a lot of complexity in us, right? Yeah.
Hello. I was wondering what you've discovered through your process around how we are relating to one another currently in our culture and our relationship to exits.
Could you say a little bit more about what you're thinking?
Sure. I'm just kind of, well, I mean, what I'm thinking about is if we're kind of really focused on beginnings and not so much on exits, which kind of states a little bit about our relationship to exits, how that might be affecting how we relate to one another. Is that not so clear?
Let me dig deep. I'm sure there's some relationship. I'm sure there's some relationship somehow not being willing to sort of go the distance. To endure the struggle, or even to recognize that that the exit has to be marked and attended to, but to sort of slip past it quickly, as if to not notice it. In other words, not take on the responsibility in relationship of really marking what's the end of it all, because I think that's often very painful. But
what's coming to me as you're sharing is, as you said, life is kind of a myriad of experiences. In mm-hmm. Buddhism, we would say it's the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. Mm-hmm. It's not just the 10,000 joys.
Yes. Yes.
Although we would like it to be that way.
Yeah.
And so, by not being with a certain part of our experience, that certainly, the question was kind of, that certainly affects how we relate to one another.
Yes.
And that was my curiosity, what your observations might be, how we're relating to one another as a culture when we're kind of not, when we're essentially turning the cheek and not paying mind to part of our contract, essentially. A big part of our lived experience, which is we're in a body, and this body will come, and it will go.
Right.
So
I think you've said it very nicely. I won't try to say it anymore. I know when I'm done. I know when I'm out of here.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.